Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 117, being recorded on the 2nd of March, 2016, with special guest Brian Lawes. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest, Brian. So, guys, it's good to have a full house for change. Kale, yeah, good to have you back.
Yeah, we've kind of been piecemealing it.
Yeah, I've been traveling too much. Yeah. Sorry.
No problem. Everything back to normal now or still crazy?
Yeah, I'm out here in snowy Ohio right now. So, coming back tomorrow.
Nice. Hopefully doing some cool stuff over there.
Yeah.
And okay, so before we get to our special guest on some of his experiences with Azure, there's a whole bunch of news, I believe. I know Kale's put some in the show notes, and I've put some too. So, Kale, you want to run through a couple of yours, and then I'll talk about mine?
Yeah, so the one that's kind of top of my list, because I work pretty much directly with this now in my new life here, is Elasticsearch. So Masashi Naramoto from the CAT team has put out some guidance basically around some of the recommended practices based on experiences we've had with running Elasticsearch in Azure. Elasticsearch being a very high-scale search product based on Lucene that's big in the open source community, but also big with a lot of large applications on the internet. And so this is a great thing. There's a template out there now, an ARM template for spinning this up, and then there's also some of the guidance based on experience with that. So I think that's, if you're looking for a really high-scale search solution, we obviously have Azure Search, and this is the open-source kind of flavor of that.
Okay. So then this is, I guess, must be coincidental that they also announced the Azure Search Basic Tier in public preview this week. So this is our Azure Search facility, which we had a free version, and I think there was a standard version, and they've now introduced a new tier right in the middle called the Basic Tier. Just comes, you know, has some limitations, 2 GB per service, etc. But interesting that that's also announced this week. But go ahead, Kale.
Yeah, and I was going to touch that next. But yeah, you know, I've used this in the past myself, and there was kind of a big gap there. So there was like a free tier, which was actually pretty good for basically dev test kind of stuff. And then we had the standard tier, but now we have one that's kind of in the middle there, which is great because you know, there's a quite a price jump there. I believe it. I don't know if the price changed, but it used to be $250 for the $250 per month to run a standard one, and I'm guessing the basics. I think the basic is around $75 a month, so that's kind of nice in the sweet spot in the middle there. And it's great because you can do like a million documents as opposed to 10,000 with the free. You could do other replicas and storage and stuff like that. So great. I think it's a great offering to have right in the middle there.
Cool.
There was a couple of notes about security out here. There's actually like two of them here that I had pulled out. Basically, we had one here from the director of incident response and recovery, like our cybersecurity group. And they were talking about basically the anatomy of a breach, you know, some common hacker routines kind of stuff. And I think there's going to be a actual meeting around this with the cyber group, and there's registrations open for that. I think it's going to be on March 8th, so that's pretty quick. I'm not sure if that's like an online thing. Have you guys heard much about that, Evan or Sajid?
I haven't heard about this, but I know, I suspect this is probably goes hand in hand with the announcement we made today about, and I forget exactly what we call it, but it's like the Enterprise Defender or something like that. But basically,
oh, yeah, I heard about this.
This is, you know, we're kind of enhancing Windows Defender, right, which ships with Windows 10 across the board. It's on, you know, it's actually shipped since, I guess, Windows 8, maybe even further back. But now, not only are we going to detect you know, when somebody's trying to attack you, but we're going to actually detect that they're there. And, you know, so we're kind of going to be watching traffic real time. But what I thought, and there is an Azure tie-in, you know, because it is the Azure podcast. But, you know, the tie-in is that all this Enterprise Defender is basically leveraging all the telemetry, all the knowledge we get of all these different attacks worldwide. And again, not just on the signature of the malware or the virus, but actually, hey, when you see this traffic pattern, you know, or this packet in this place with this data, then that's an attack. And this is the attack it goes with. And because this is leveraging worldwide data, right, theoretically, and again, you know, remains to be seen what the offering looks like, but theoretically, you know, now you could really catch stuff much, much, much faster because you're leveraging the worldwide source of this stuff.
That's pretty interesting. And it's, again, another coincidence over here. One of the news items, well, the new offerings from Azure this week was something called the Azure Active Directory Identity Protection.
Yeah, it's similar, along the same line.
So along similar lines, it's, you know, it provides some sort of a consolidated view of suspicious sign-ins, potential vulnerabilities, et cetera. And, you know, it'll look for things like brute force attacks, leak credentials, sign-ins from unfamiliar locations, et cetera. So it looks like along the same vein as what you just described.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of neat because you think about it, we used to kind of do this on, I mean, we already do this on some level, right? All the, you know, people find a virus, they analyze it and figure out its signature. But that was always kind of looking at the binaries and you know, when you found you were breached, right, you had to go figure out from the, you know, if you found you were hacked, you had to go figure out how you were hacked, right? How the breach actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know if I got some buddy on the security team, and man, it is a non-trivial thing to figure this out after the fact, right? Because you don't really know the vector or anything. It really sounds like these kind of capabilities are really enabling us to kind of see this stuff semi-real time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and actually see that, hey, there's this brand new thing, this is how you detect it, and then we're pushing that out to everybody, leveraging the, you know, I'm sure the machine learning capabilities and everything to kind of figure this out much, much faster.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and along with that, guys, too, there's another thing with security that come out. It's it looks like from Japan. There's been some certification, so another one of those ISO certifications that we have that are important to typically financial services or those important organizations that are looking for those certifications for like how we do audits and the cloud security. So it looks like we have one from Japan this week, so another security thing.
Yeah, no, definitely cool.
Excellent. And then there's a bunch of SQL Server enhancements, Azure SQL database enhancements this week.
Yeah, I'll talk about these. I mean, I think these are unbelievably cool because, as an ex-SQL Server support engineer, one of the biggest calls we would get was, hey, you know, my application's underperforming, right? Either it just started today, you know, it fell off the cliff, or it's always been bad. And there have always been ways to leverage DMVs and everything to kind of figure this out real time. But what's really neat about what we're doing in Azure SQL Database, and some of this is in SQL Server 2016.
Yeah, sorry.
It's in there as well. But what we're adding on top of this is, you know, we're really kind of taking away some of the low-end DBA stuff. I mean, because let's be honest, right? DBAs, you know, they're really smart people. They know how to write really cool queries, but they really aren't using their skills right when they go run a query against a DMV, and the DMV says, "Hey, this is the, you know, the index you should add." Mm. Right? That's not really where you want your DBA to spend time. What you want them spending time is crafting the right T-SQL. And you know, the Index Advisor and the Query Store and Performance, Index Advisor and Query Store are all about kind of enabling the non-DBA to make sure that they're database is actually performing well. I saw a demo on the Query Store that where they could actually see, hey, yesterday this query ran in 50 milliseconds and today it's running in 200,
right,
and then it's been 200 since then. Well, now let's go back in time and say, oh, wow, the query plan changed, and oh, by the way, the query changed.
Yep, and you can see exactly when it fell off.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just amazing because now you don't have to, you know, really, you know, run around trying to track all that stuff all the time. And then the query performance insight part, and this is the ironic thing about cloud, right? We're all about optimizing what you use. We're not necessarily about soaking you for money, right? I mean, the query performance insight looks at your databases, looks at your consumption of the Azure SQL database resources to make sure that you're using the right size. You know, and as well, you know, this kind of tells you, hey, this is kind of an overall perspective of your database so that, you know that you're tuned right and that you're using the right size database for what you're doing, because why overuse, right? Yeah. If you can optimize some queries and then drop down to a smaller DTU instance, that's going to save you money.
And then they have this query performance insight. You saw that?
Yeah, that was what I was talking about kind of being able to look at your overall database holistically
Does that use the other two services? I think it sort of aggregates all the other advisors, et cetera, like the query index advisor. Does it just roll that up into a uniform tool? Because, you know, you have all these tools now, right, for SQL.
Yeah. I'm actually not sure. I'll have to go spend some more time playing with it to understand kind of how we surface that stuff. But, I mean, it's all kind of around the same end solution, right?
Right.
Make your database as efficient as possible with minimum, with minimum effort on your side.
Right.
Right, so that you can focus on kind of the core part of your business, which is selling whatever widget, you sell.
Yeah. Nice. Very nice. So, Kale, did we get to all of yours?
Yeah, I just had one more, and this actually touches on some things, too, Evan, about SQL Server. There was a blog post out there about some it was basically entitled about hybrid offerings, but it kind of had a lot of stuff about SQL Server on there. And I think we talked about this in the past, but 2016 with the Stretch database. Being able to go up into Azure, I think that's out there. There's also, I didn't know this was possible, so 2016 is going to have support for transactional replication to an Azure SQL database.
Yeah, I saw that. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, that's going to open up, doors that I've seen where that was blocking before. It was like, we wish that we could replicate from, like, this IaaS or this on-premise up there, so I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
so is this
really
kind
cool.
of like mirroring or log shipping, or what are they doing there? Or is it
transactional TranRepl, as they call it in the business, is really where they take every transaction and is actually, we're replicating individual transactions across. So it's, in some ways, it's kind of a precursor to mirroring and always on. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you can do with transactional replication that you can't do with mirroring and always on is you can actually have two different sources, and this is kind of merge replication, but you can have two different sources feeding into each other.
Mm.
Right. So replication has some capabilities that even today we don't really have in always on and database mirroring.
Got it.
But to be able to do that across Azure SQL database really opens up some capabilities from a Stretch perspective.
That is cool. All right. Well, then let's get to our guest, Brian Lawes. Brian, thank you for being patient as we rambled a little bit over here. And we would love if you could just give our listeners a quick overview as to your background and how you've been able to leverage Azure and what your passion is with regard to Azure.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, good to meet you guys. Big fan. I've listened to pretty loyal, so I've listened a lot, and I really thank you guys for what you do. It's been important for me since I'm busy as a consultant. I got to take in a lot of information and keep up with stuff as a cloud architect, and it is really helpful to have this feed coming from you guys on what's changing. It's really saved me a lot of struggle as I'm trying to figure out the lay of the land. So I really appreciate what you guys are doing.
Happy to. It's a lot
thank
of fun.
You. Yeah. So as for me, I'm a cloud architect at Summit 7 Systems. We are really focused on SharePoint and Office 365. And really anything that has to do with those, we're your guys for that. But for me, I have a roundabout background. I actually started computer science and switched history and English, right? So that's my background. But I weaseled my way into IT, self-taught, went from web dev, VBA, virtualization infrastructure, then on to SharePoint from a dev and admin and an architecture angle. So really recently been moving really heavily into the cloud space. Really been enjoying that, man. There's just so much you can do. It's so cool, so impressive. so many benefits. It's just, it's really exciting. And actually, what I'm looking for right now is back in November, I'm trying to coin a new term, the Cloud Pro. It's the mixture between dev and IT pro that the new cloud professional really kind of needs to get. It's kind of a new space that people are trying to find themselves in. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, what does it mean to be a cloud pro as opposed to like an IT pro or a dev?
I like it. That's a nice name.
Yeah, I think so. I'll fit well in a T-shirt.
Yeah, he signed me onto it, and I've been pitching it everywhere I go too. So
cool.
So as far as Azure goes, we recently completed a project for a major public institution, a college system, and they have a pretty decent size a SharePoint on-premises farm, and they're looking to shift it from a service provider, a hoster, into Azure IaaS. They found that would actually save them some significant amount of money. And, we were very confident that we'd be able to host, a pretty decent sized SharePoint farm sitting inside of Azure. Hopefully to also then kind of set an entrance for, additional workloads moving onto it.
And that's a smart way to approach it always. You know, anytime someone's getting into the cloud first, you go with their core applications that they already know and love and move that to the cloud and then go for other things.
Yeah, we kind of were taking it from an angle of, hey, if we can do it with SharePoint, application X probably can do that as well.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Are you saying SharePoint has performance issues? Oh, come on.
Not this farm.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, though. I mean, SharePoint, it's a phenomenally powerful application, and when deployed right, it runs like a charm, but it is, because of all with great power comes a lot of complexity, right? People can absolutely mess it up, and I think if my memory serves me right, you guys actually had to iterate a little bit to figure out the best way to lay this thing out.
Yeah, we started, of course, with the development environment, right? We don't want to shift it all the way to production and go, I guess it didn't perform, right? So we wanted to make sure that it definitely would. And so when first round through, we did exactly like you said. We built the thing, we tweaked a little bit, did some performance testing. We were particularly trying to figure out really what's the best story for stuff like load balancing, because it is publicly accessible. Stuff like particularly around storage. We also needed to try to figure out, once we reached production, what would really be the story around Active Directory. We started our dev environment in the US East region, but premium storage at that time was not available in US East. And so we need to go to US East 2. So now the question, I think this is what you're referring to, Evan, is, well, do we need an Active Directory domain controller set up there? Do we need VPN there? You know, is the fact that there's the site-to-site, connection between US East and US East 2, is that sufficient?
Right.
And these are some of the questions that we are trying to answer. And ultimately, what we determined, by the way, on that was we found that having the domain controllers in US East, not US East 2, did work just fine for us.
Yeah. So and just to be clear for the audience, so what you guys were doing is you were leveraging the VNet to VNet capabilities to span the fact that you didn't quite have access to the resources you wanted to in the first data center you started, but you didn't want to tear everything down and recreate it just to get access to that.
That's right. Right. So I think ultimately the goal will be to put those DCs in US East 2 to cover, just in case. But we're trying to really find ways that we can save the customer money. We've definitely been a rough period of time, and there's been some budget cuts. And so really we were trying to find ways to decrease the overhead and the overhead of just the dollars, but also of maintenance and administration.
Yeah, so the and just to throw out, you know, and I'd be love to, if you ever go this way, love to have you come back. But right now we've got the DC as a service where you don't even have to administer your DCs. But one question, you know, a lot of times I see when customers kind of just wholesale pick up their workloads and move it from on-premises to Azure, kind of, you know, CPU or compute minute for compute minute, it actually ends up costing a little bit more in Azure. If you have a very well-tuned on-premises data center, because you probably didn't have to buy the hardware, right? The hardware was probably already there. So, you know, when you guys were looking at the cost, like, what was driving the fact that they were actually saving money? Was this on maintenance on-premises, or what was driving that?
I wish I had actual access to the dollars and cents. What I was assured of by the customer is that just raw hosting, mm-hmm. They were actually able to save money just straight up.
Wow, that's amazing.
It helps that, you know, as an EA customer, Enterprise Agreement, they're a large, they have, I think it's 400,000 seats technically inside of Office 365. A big customer. Yep. So they got a good discount as well from Microsoft. So one of the call outs and lessons for people would be to, you know, talk to your Microsoft rep. Maybe you are able to pull a pretty good deal on Azure.
Hey Brian, I had one question too. Since you do a lot of SharePoint work, what are you seeing out there when you're doing, like, especially migrations that are involving like Azure? In this case, it sounded like it was like an IaaS solution, but like, what do you see as far as like people moving to the SharePoint Online versus, you know, SharePoint IaaS? Is it really around they have these custom solutions kind of built in there, or are you seeing people move to the PaaS type model with SharePoint Online?
Yeah, good question. This customer, like I said, also had Office 365, so they are very interested and active with SharePoint Online. They weren't able to do that wholesale shift over to SharePoint Online yet. I think that is in the roadmap. And what we're finding, though, is a lot of customers are really seeing Office 365 as a replacement for the on-prem. A lot of people, they just really don't want to be in the business of hosting their SharePoint, particularly when there's an easy and pretty inexpensive means to do that through Office 365. We are, though, finding that there definitely are still people who want to hold on to it. Like I said, there's the custom solutions, right? Our customers haven't really had issues around the sovereignty, you know, data sovereignty. We're U.S. based, but we're dealing with a customer now who has a lot of concerns around PCI compliance and HIPAA and stuff like that. And they're rather gun shy about moving some of that data across.
Yeah, send them to the Azure Trust Center. I think PCI is a whole nother beast because it's more about how you handle stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, definitely sounds like that person needs to spend some time digging through the Trust Center.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're looking to utilize some of the new stuff like DLP, you know, data loss prevention, some of these things and the auditing capabilities. And I'm trying to craft some of my own to help give them that assurance, particularly when there's external sharing involved.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Now, Brian, I'm just curious, when you moved these to the IaaS VMs, how did you size your IaaS VMs, like figure out which, you know, which type you needed, like whatever, the A4, A5, I'm not sure which ones you finally went for.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the exact. I think I actually went primarily with D3s. What I did, it's just nice and easy, is I looked at the list of all of the VMs sizes, and I tried to find the one that fit best into what Microsoft has as the minimum requirements. Technically we could have gone smaller, but you know, being the minimum requirements, I don't want to give support to any reason.
Wait,
potentially
wait a minute, there's,
what?
Oh. There's a customer out there that actually follows those minimum requirements. Wow. Sorry, that's the support guy coming out.
Yeah, we're trying to turn to that. So, because I want to make life as easy, as simple for the customer as possible. So, you know, I don't want to give any reason for, you know, to eventually be turned away to say, hey, you know, you got too many, you know, you have your memory's too small, go resize it, come talk back to me, you know?
Yeah.
So we actually, yes, so like I said, I pretty much found the one that matches. And then for the ones that have a higher memory need, namely the search machines, I found one with a similar but with a higher memory. So it's just a matter of trying to match well. We have not gone through the exercise yet. They haven't really had a need to yet of trying to tweak the sizes down. They're satisfied with it as is.
Okay. That's what I was going to – that's actually what I was going to ask about is because, you know, one of the things that I really, really encourage people to get in the cloud is, you know, when you're starting out, pick whatever you think is closest. But what's really nice in Azure is, you know, if you decide you need to change your size either up or down, yes, it is a reboot, but it's not like on-premises where you have to rebuild something, right? And then on top of that, the other kind of question and kind of related is, have you guys looked at, you know, taking advantage of some of the auto scale to say, hey, it's the weekend, you know, the students or the staff are not around, so we're going to size these things down, or is this kind of like a static size for now, and that's probably a future thing?
And I would it would be my all right, this is my geek coming out. I would love to spend like 2 months just working on doing that. The reason why I can't is because just simply SharePoint does not do well with auto provisioning and pulling up on the spot and growing like that. I would love to do the automation, do that. There really isn't that desired state configuration, and scripting capability is quite the same as,
You're actually talking scale out, though. What I'm trying to talk about is the scale up or scale down mentality.
I hear you're getting at. They have not found the need to do that, although I have. Okay. They do understand, and I've given them the recommendation of something like SharePoint. You want a lot of redundancy,
yep.
Two of everything. So you can get really creative and save costs by just, for example, shutting off one leg of that overnight, for example. You have to a little bit of complexity around, how do you patch it if sometimes offline overnight,
yep.
but you do have that flexibility. Thankfully, they haven't really found the need to yet. Pricing has been good enough for them, I suppose.
Question I guess I would have too for you around your experiences around the database side of it, because SharePoint.
Yeah, I was going to ask that too. Yeah.
I was just wanting my question. I don't know what you were asking, Sujit, or wanted to ask, but the question I had is, when you see people, and this is based on what I've seen too, when they move an application to the cloud, maybe it's not even SharePoint, but in your case, SharePoint, will they re-architect or change their SQL environment at all? Like, are you seeing them like where they had some bad stuff, maybe even on-prem, and you say, hey, when you go to the cloud, we got to make sure we have duplicates of some of this stuff that you didn't have on-prem, because you were kind of hugging your servers when they were close to you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We found that really the storage on the SQL Server was our primary performance point, our concern. The first time when we built the farm, it was in the dev environment, identically sized, and all of that. And we ran performance tests, compared them against production, which we used premium storage on. And it was a huge difference. The simple fact of shifting to premium storage was enough to cover all kinds of multitudes of evils. The customer had solid state on their production environment as well. And although there were some spots where maybe the on-prem was ever so slightly more performant, on the whole, there was a significant increase in performance on the SQL Server simply by being on premium storage. We had options that we could have, used even more disks or, more SSDs, premium storage, could have, storage spaced them, all kinds of stuff. But we found that just simply having one I think it was a P3 disk for one for logs and one P3 disk for data was really all they needed. So, in fact, I think what we found is it actually simplified the design somewhat because of the performance of the premium storage.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know, I may not know the SharePoint environment as well as you guys, but I was wondering if there was any chance to use SQL Azure. Can you use SharePoint with SQL?
Not yet.
No. Not yet, no.
So you have to install your own version of SQL Server in a separate IIS instance. Okay,
that's right.
I guess that answer. And then, since you mentioned performance, how, like, you know, what was your like, what was your benchmark? How did you, you know, tell the customer or prove to the customer that okay, this works even better or as well as good as what you had on premise? You know, I mean, sure, they must have wanted to know that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we did is we got Visual Studio Ultimate, built some tests, web tests inside of it to just do some pretty basic browsing, for example, of the sites. We then did the load tests based on those to, you know, to try a test of, for example, sustained, you know, at sustained level, try to determine what the capacity is, you know, gradually increasing. So we did a couple different load tests. And we ran it against their test tenant, the test environment, their new production, and their old production. So we were able to really see much more apples to apples of the impact. What for us was the simplest, and this stuff is in a blog that I wrote, the premium storage, we were able to really identify the benefits by just doing a simple full crawl. So we just... Because, you know, when you crawl in SharePoint, it hits the disk hard. That's one of the hardest ways you can guarantee that you're really going to just put a massive load on your disks. And by when we did that, we were able to compare and look at, like, the crawl rate, you know, how many documents per minute, as well as the latencies. And we found that those were significantly higher than with standard storage in Azure as well as on premises.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
So customers happy with the move,
very.
And they're looking at, as a future enhancement, they're looking at maybe SharePoint Online, see if they can migrate their stuff off there.
Mm-hmm. That's down the road somewhat, looking at 2016 and seeing maybe what happened there. One of the things we're actually doing now, which might be interested, some of your listeners might be interested in, is, you know, one of the concerns that we had and that we're finding as a performance issue is, although Azure, it's nice and quick up there in the cloud, but we're crawling on-premises file shares. So that means it's got to pull those files over the VPN into the farm, you know, across the internet. They don't have, you know, express route.
Mm.
And so what we're finding is basically those external connections to on-premises stuff, be it file shares or some backend database, is going to now have latencies that we didn't have planned on before. And so what we're actually doing is with SharePoint 2013 August CU and the or SharePoint 2016 is there's now something called the Cloud Search Service Application, and that'll actually send the index, the contents, up into the index in Office 365. And so what we're doing is we're actually going to deploy a really small farm on premises for the purpose of crawling that stuff there on premises and not having to suck it over the, you know, the VPN and send that up to the cloud. So we're finding interesting ways to kind of work around some of those latency issues that we're seeing after the move.
So let me make sure I understand that. So that sounds like you're just basically sending up the index at that mm-hmm. point. Oh, okay.
Effectively, yeah.
That makes sense. Okay.
That's very, very innovative. Very nice.
Yeah, and so that way both, you know, you have both of those little, you know, there's the main farm, and then there's a little search, the crawling farm. They're both keyed into the same endpoints in Office 365, and then people just go to Office 365 to do their searches.
Now,
that's nice.
Now, did the customer see any impact in terms of the maintenance or administration or management of this service as it was on-premises and in the cloud? Was there any issues there, either political or otherwise?
Not political, but they do, I think, have some advantage that they didn't otherwise have. So they were, you know, with a hoster, right? So they're behind a, you know, firewall, paywall or whatever. They don't have direct access to the machines. By hosting it themselves in Azure, they're able to actually now go and onto the machines, add ports, do whatever they need to. You know, like what if the VPN has problems and this has happened? How do you get to the machines? Well, they can just go on in the Azure portal, add, you know, the RDP port, and boom, they're inside the servers. That would have been very difficult before with the hoster. There have been some little bit of challenges, though, that come along. namely the hoster. A lot of times hosters will add extra services. Like, for example, they had in their plan a item level backup of SharePoint. It's not necessarily a simple thing, not necessarily a cheap thing. But by moving away from the hoster, they no longer have access to that anymore, right? So you kind of got to look at the entirety of what your hoster provides if you're going to hoster.
That's what I was going to ask. So it sounds like, and in this sense it made sense for this customer, is that you have to kind of balance, okay, so you're going to be responsible for some of the maintenance type stuff, but now you're not having to pay the hoster's fee, because, they're allowed to make money on top of stuff, right?
Absolutely.
And then you're going to pick up some of these, extra things you have to do, but at the same time, you don't have to buy the hardware. You're not paying the margin on the hoster. So you're kind of, in some ways, cutting out a middleman in the end, but you're still getting, it has to be because they wouldn't have done this otherwise, but they're getting a big chunk of the benefit the hoster was giving them for ultimately a total, lump sum cost is still less than if they were doing it that way.
That's right. And, at the end of the day, a VM's a VM. As long as it's built well and performant, a VM is a VM. Whether or not it's in a hoster, if it's in your personal data center, or if it's in Azure, you still manage the VMs and the environment the same as you would before, except in their case, they have more access to the VM and the infrastructure than they did before.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Excellent. Well, now this sounds like and actually what we'll do in the show notes for the audience is because you actually wrote about this on your blog, right? We'll post the link so people can see it, because I think you guys did a really well thought out kind of approach, and some of the data you found was cool, so definitely give you guys credit for that.
Great, thanks. And really, I think the message I want to carry forward is you really can, if you plan well and you design well, you really can host top level, large enterprise applications on Azure. If you're prepared for it, if you think it through, it's definitely doable. It wasn't that hard.
That's cool. Well, and just so the audience knows, that was the non-Microsoft guy saying that.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah, and we didn't pay him any money to say that.
Yet.
Yeah, we pay him the same. We pay him the same money that we pay each other to show up, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you, Brian. That's excellent. Excellent information for our listeners. Yeah. Appreciate you taking the time to come on the show here. And we'll definitely share some of your insights on the show notes. Send us the links, and we'll put it out there.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Brian.
Pleasure.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.